Seated. I want you to know this morning that it's not true that all pastors avoid talking about sex or sexuality like they're biblical plagues. In fact, I know about a pastor who placed an empty shoebox in the entryway of the church and invited the congregation to place any questions they had, including questions about sex, into that box. He promised to answer them in the church newsletter. Here's the very first letter he responded to. Dear Pastor, I hope you can help me. The other day I left for work, leaving my husband in the house watching TV. I had not gone more than a mile down the road when the engine died and the car shuddered to a halt. I walked back home to get my husband's help. When I got home, I couldn't believe my eyes. My husband was in the bedroom, passionately engaged with a neighbor lady. When I confronted him, he said that he had gone into the backyard, heard a lady scream, went to her rescue, but found her unconscious. He then carried her back to our house, placed her on the bed, and began CPR. When she came to, she immediately began thanking him and kissing him, and he was attempting to break free when I walked in. Can you please help me, Pastor? Sincerely, Mrs. Jane Doe. Here's the pastor's reply. Dear Jane, a car stalling after being driven a short distance can be caused by a variety of faults with the engine. Start by checking that there is no obstruction in the fuel line. If it is clear, check the Jubilee clips holding the vacuum pipes onto the inlet manifold. If none of these remedies solves the problem, it could be a faulty fuel pump, which would cause low delivery pressure to the carburetor float chamber. I hope this helps. Your pastor. This morning, I'm not going to be that pastor. I'm going to be the one that you deserve, who will talk to you about intimate sexual relationships. And I begin with a brief word about intimacy from the perspectives of both men and women. And I'm fully aware that two categories is too simple. But not having yet good language or information to talk about more, I just offer the two. In the book Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus by John Grays, Grays explains some common misperceptions and stereotypes about men and women and sexual intimacy. Women often criticize men for being sex machines, for being too easily and indiscriminately aroused, and for their likelihood of having sexual liaisons outside of their primary relationships. Men, on the other hand, cannot seem to understand why women are so sexually repressed or why lesbians show such an affinity for U-Haul trailers. Nancy Chodorow's study on sexuality and socialization tells us some important things for both men and women. First, for the men, Chodorow explains that in cultures where raising children is primarily the work of the mother, boys learn to define their gender identity by separating from their mother. In other words, they learn to associate their own maleness with being separate, with being apart, with being autonomous. What this means, according to Labax and Barton, is that the opposite of separation, which is intimacy, is often seen as a threat to male identity. Males are taught that emotion and intimacy are not to be trusted and that they cannot be expressed by real men. And so men learn to genitalize every strong emotion, and the effect is arousal. When men feel strongly about another person, they move quickly to genital involvement. Dr. James Nelson tells us that this is exactly the reason for much of the homophobia that's present in our society. Many men fear that strong feelings for other men, whether friends or mentors, will lead to genital attraction. So they impose strong constraints on their friendships and other relationships with other men. Now, you know, if all this is true, then gay men might actually be the most sexually evolved of all people. And while we're giving men a break, considering all that they must overcome, we need to give women a break too. Forget that women are from Venus, the planet named for the goddess of love. Margaret Nichols, in a major essay on lesbian sexuality, cites a study that claims that sexual desire requires some kind of tension. Sexual desire requires some kind of tension, a taboo, a power discrepancy, the excitement of newness, or the thrill of the chase that we call romance. The study also claims that women are taught from a very early age that the only one of these tensions that leads to acceptable sexual desire is romance, is the ladylike feeling of romance and the thrill of the chase. Now that goes a long way toward explaining those U-Hauls. Many women must fall in love, or at least be able to claim that they are falling in love, before they allow themselves to be sexual. Add to this all kinds of feminine angst over things like, are we perpetuating patriarchal sexual norms when we dress up or wear makeup to appear physically attractive? And men, while we're giving you a break, you should consider this. Far from making fun of us women, you should consider every walking, talking, minimally functioning woman a miracle in self-awareness and strength of character. According to Helene Brenner, PhD, psychologist and author of I Know I'm In There Somewhere, intimacy can be rather simply summed up. And there are four areas of intimacy that she names. First, emotional intimacy, she says. To bolster emotional intimacy, you should break it down into three parts. Slow down, keep it simple, and share what is hard to say. She suggests that you say things like this: I got hurt, I got scared. I love you. I miss you. I'm scared to tell you how much you matter to me. Don't rely on all kinds of qualifiers to pad out your feelings. Instead, get right to the root with unfiltered honesty. Above all, for emotional intimacy, she says, allow yourself to be vulnerable. She then talks about mental intimacy. Consider mental intimacy as a meeting of the minds. For some people, she says, this is about a sense of humor and bouncing things off of each other and challenging each other. Mental intimacy, she says, can also be great talks about movies or a play you saw or a career that you're both involved in or causes that matter to you. A third form of intimacy, she says, is spiritual intimacy. And this one can be very tricky because it's rare for two people in a couple or friendship, she says, to be similarly in touch with their spirituality, to express and feel and understand their religion or their spirituality in the same way. But she reminds us, spirituality can take different forms or expressions. Spirituality can be as simple as a code of values or ethics You don't have to use spiritual language or practices to talk about those things. If your partner, Dr. Brenner says, is not spiritually inclined, find spiritual intimacy by expressing to your partner what your spirituality means to you, how it makes you a better person or gives more meaning to your life. Express to your partner how your faith, how your spiritual journey means something to you, how it makes you a better person, how it gives your life meaning. And fourth, physical intimacy, she says, is essentially about just relaxing into it, joining in the flow of it, getting into the moment. Physical intimacy is about sharing, giving, getting, and expressing what feels good. It's all about connection, excitement, the giving and getting of pleasure, and closeness, Dr. Brenner says. Keeping those four areas of intimacy in mind, I'm going to go through six characteristics of intimate relationships that were offered by writer Marcy Crane. Number one, you stand the test of time. Intimate lovers stand the test of time. In the beginning, neurochemicals are in charge. When those start to taper off, or go away, real intimacy can begin. I want to share this story with you from Elizabeth Stewart's book, Just Good Friends. She says, I believe that in the secret places of our lives, we yearn for relationships based upon mutuality, justice, compassion, and complete affirming acceptance. But for that yearning to be fulfilled, she says, complete and utter vulnerability, radical vulnerability, must exist between the partners. We long to, quote, jump about stark naked, to use a phrase of Kierkegaard's, to be completely ourselves with another person and for them to be so with us, and to grow from that vulnerability into the best that we both can be. But, here's the but, within the sinful context in which we live and in which we have been formed, the attainment of such radical vulnerability requires enormous effort and a great deal of time. Because radical vulnerability is a process, not a moment, achieved above all through a journey into deeper and deeper trust, based upon mutual exposure of ourselves, we need to remain intimate partners. We need some assurance that the other person will be there tomorrow to reaffirm us as we are and will struggle through the inevitable problems and tensions that arise in relationships. Intimate partnerships stand the test of time. Number two, you figure out how to be a couple and how to be separate individuals. Couples, especially after they get through that stage where the neurochemicals are in charge, have to find a way to maintain their individual interest and their individual pursuits. I tell the couples when I'm performing a marriage ceremony, I tell the couples, you may mean the world to each other, but you cannot be the world to each other. In fact, many people don't understand that couples can become too close. They can become what we call enmeshed. Dr. Hugh Level is a marriage and family therapist. He says, on the one hand, enmeshed partners get very close to each other, which you would think is a good thing. But since they only have a few people in their social universe, a conflict within the main relationship means conflict throughout the social universe. Losing that one person means losing one's entire social universe. That's a very scary thought. And so when these enmeshed couples do have problems, they tend to just cover over them, to ignore them. They give up their own identity to please their partner, and they continue to draw closer and closer. However, that ends up being an illusion. On the one hand, couples get closer, but on the other hand, getting that close to someone represents a loss of individuality. Enmeshed partners, partners that are too close, too interwound, begin to resent each other for not being perfect and for not being able to provide everything that they want. When we get to that point, even a small problem that arises starts a fight. The fight spins out of control, and then the partners, when they're totally exhausted, withdraw from each other for a while. What happens then? They start recognizing that the loss of that partner with whom they are enmeshed is the loss of their entire social universe. So they come back together and once again start to cover over the problems, ignore where the areas of tension are, and the whole cycle starts again. To remain in an intimate relationship, you must remain yourself, you must retain your self-identity. Number three, she says, in intimate relationships between intimate partners, you feel good about yourself. An intimate relationship is fulfilling and healthy, and it helps you believe in your own value and in your own potential. Stephanie Paulsell, in her book, Honoring the Body, describes her experience of falling in love with her husband and of their beginning intimacy and what it meant for her own acceptance of her own body. She says, one night, he seemed not to be satisfied with the status quo between us. He suggested something more. "It'll feel so good," he said. I was in love, so I said, "Well, sure, why not?" He suggested we start out slowly. I started to feel myself speeding up. I was panting and groaning loudly. Anyone could have heard, but Kevin kept saying, "You're doing great, you're doing great. Let's speed up." And I did, and felt the pleasure of pushing my body beyond its boundaries. It was a physical pleasure, the pleasure of feeling myself wholly embodied, of feeling blood and breath moving through me. It was a spiritual pleasure, the relief of feeling old fears and inhibitions drained of their power. It was a feeling of freedom and possibility. And it was a sexual pleasure, the pleasure of feeling someone I love drawing out of my strength, urging me on, matching his body's rhythm to mine. It is one of my husband's enduring gifts to me, Paulsell says, that he reintroduced me to the joy of my body. Through honoring my body and its strength, he helped me begin to do the same. Because she learned to honor her body, Paulsell learned to love herself as an erotic being, one who experiences physical, spiritual, and sexual pleasure. And by the way, the experience that Paulsell was describing was not a sexual one. She and her future husband decided on that night that rather than taking a long walk together, as she usually preferred, they would go on a 4-mile run around the gymnasium track. Number four. To remain intimate lovers, you need to maintain a sense of play. Maturity and fun are not mutually exclusive. Couples in adult relationships should strive to cultivate their sense of play. A truly playful personality can let go of worries, it can let go of intellectual concerns and be in the moment. A sense of play, study after study tells us, a sense of play and a sense of humor does more to light the romantic fires than almost any other aspect of a relationship. Number five, she says, acknowledge faults in each other, but don't get upset. I'm going to truncate that. I'm going to stop after the first word, acknowledge. Acknowledge. I'm going to stop with acknowledge, talk, communicate. This is the sad truth that six gay activists in New York told us way back in 1987. Silence equals death. Way back in 1987, as AIDS began to kill their friends and lovers by the thousands, they told us silence equals death. And of course, they specifically meant their refusal to talk about the causes and consequences of HIV and AIDS. But let's expand on that. It is time, it's past time, that faith communities learn to talk about sex without embarrassment, without innuendo and euphemism, without contempt for ourselves or those who think about sex differently than we do. Sex is a natural function of our bodies. It's a natural craving of our psyches. It's a natural expression of our emotions. Sex, like all good gifts, is God-given, and like all good gifts, we can treasure it and give thanks for it, or we can fail to appreciate it, misuse it, or even waste it. With your intimate lovers, acknowledge. Talk about it all, especially the things that you're often taught not to talk about. Talk about politics, religion. Talk about money and your budget and your income and your dreams, especially if you disagree about these things. Talk about your past, your sexual abuse, preferences. Talk about fidelity and what faithfulness means in your relationship. Talk, talk, talk. And number six, she says, you serve one another. Last week I talked about serving intimate friends and how Jesus served his friends in many ways, but specifically by washing the dust of the road from their feet. I want to change this one just a little bit to place it more in the context of our faith and in our worship this morning. I want to talk about not just intimacy, but compassion. One of the reasons that we serve one another is that we have compassion for one another. Compassion motivates people to go out of their way to help the physical, mental, or emotional pains of another person. The novelist Martin Amis tells a story about the mending power of sexual intimacy and compassion in his memoir, Experience. He tells this story that after years of unrelenting tooth pain and disease, all of his teeth were removed and replaced. In the midst of the long, excruciating process, he had to wear for several weeks a prosthetic device that caused his mouth to fill with saliva and made it difficult for him to talk or eat. It made him drool. It made him feel ugly and undesirable. That night, he writes to his wife, that night, after he had been fitted with the false teeth, he writes, you came belly dancing out of the bathroom, wearing A, your silk bathrobe, and B, my false teeth. Both were then removed. This, he says, was the war against shame. The next morning, I woke early and lay there quietly, laughing and weeping into the pillow. I felt fragile, guileless, and exquisitely consoled. After mastectomy, after cesarean delivery, after prostatectomy, after chemo and its resulting hair loss, all of it, offer to one another compassion. Compassion. If you have a desire to actually serve your partner, put his or her needs above your own, you've achieved, and let me say, and not giving up your own, but if you can sometimes put them above and always at least equal to your own, you've achieved a status of relationship that not many couples ever get to. Yes, friends, it's time that, especially in our faith communities, we learn to talk about sex without embarrassment, without innuendo, without contempt for ourselves, that sometimes happens, without contempt for those who think about sex very differently than we do. It is a natural function of our bodies, and our bodies are holy. God so loved the world that God sent Jesus in a human body to live among us and let us know how holy and beautiful human bodies can be. James B. Nelson says, Jesus, to the horror of squeamish Christians, was a laughing, crying, sweating, eating, drinking, digesting, urinating, sexual, sensuous bundle of flesh, just as we are. If we cannot believe that, we shall have difficulty believing in the holiness of our own bodies. If we cannot believe that, we shall have difficulty believing that we meet God in other human bodies. We meet God in flesh. But here is the good news, Nelson says. God embraces human flesh as the fitting vehicle of divine presence. God's embodiment continues wherever our love becomes flesh and our flesh becomes love. Being Christ in the world, just as we talked about last week, is a full-bodied experience. It's marvelous, and it's messy. If we are to be the body of Christ, we must bring our whole selves, including our bodies, to the task. We must touch, and we must be touched. Touch the soft petals of a rose. Touch the scars of the abused. We must taste the sweetness of a lover's kiss and also the bitterness of those betrayed and left lonely. We must hear waters falling softly into a pool, and we must hear the cries of fathers whose children are taken too soon. We can see the beauty of a woman's body and the poverty in which many women live. We can smell the richness of our feasts and the bodies dying in the desert for lack of food. All this we can do when we are embodied. We must bring to the world our whole selves, our God-created selves, our God-imagined selves, our sensitive, sensual, sacred, created in the image of God selves. When we are comfortable in our own bodies, when we can celebrate them and cuddle them and bathe and dress and feed them, when we can tuck them in and tickle them awake and feed them grapes one by one, only then can we truly hope to be the body of Christ in the world. Amen.